This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Called Kingdom of Piracy, and it was an online project that was looking at artists' sort of responses to ideas of like free information exchange and challenging the worldwide intellectual property regime. It was a very interesting sort of nomadic online project that kind of took residence at different institutions, including in Liverpool, where I was living at that time. And I think the last time we did a panel discussion together was at Ars Electronica in 2003. And we didn't have phones or something. Like, I don't know why we didn't have phones, but it ended up that like I had the key to the hotel room and I had to wait for Armin at the train station in Linz. 4 a.m. for him to come in because of some like really cheap economy ticket I had purchased for him to attend. And so this panel discussion, you know, we've really come a long way since then, but I think what's really exciting about it is that Armin's interest in contemporary artists using sort of ideas of creating different kinds of commons carried through into this research project, which he sustained over a period of years working in London. And pursuing his PhD that now results in this this book, which is a really fascinating history of a story of art and technology and experimentation and visual art research from non-aligned countries through the 60s and early 70s that, you know, really challenges a lot of the art historical narratives that I had sort of received in my own training. So it was really exciting to kind of engage with this project. And Armin is going to present it in just a moment. Following Armin's presentation, we'll be joined by two panelists, Rachel Wetzler, a PhD student and art critic and researcher who works on topics related to this, and Ava Diaz, my wife. Thank you very much for coming, Ava, who's an art historian and art critic who recently published the book The Experimenters, which looks at experimentation as a part of artistic practice at Black Mountain College and sort of traces some of the related trajectories to this kind of body of practice. And yes, so I'm very excited for this discussion, and I'm going to turn it over now to you, Armin, to take us through the world of new tendencies.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael. I don't know if this works. Can you hear me okay? Yeah? Okay, great. I would like to thank Michael a lot because, as he already told, we have been working together a long time ago. I was already more or less the same age, because when you become middle-aged, you're always the same age. And Michael was really young back then. And we had a successful collaboration. And that moment was really memorable when he waited at the platform at 4:30 in the morning or 3:30. For me, this book, also to tell a little bit about myself, is part of a trajectory that took me out of where I maybe originally came from. I started working as a so-called media artist in the 1980s. Then my projects got bigger and bigger. And then I started to become sort of a curator, as it's now called. Back then, we didn't even see it like that. And then I sort of ended up suddenly being editor of an online journal, and then went back into curating and all that. But I have witnessed the development of a field that is still a sort of unstable field, and where it's very difficult to find the right vocabulary, because I think terms such as media art and digital art are not adequate anymore to it. But still, those fields do also have some specificity to them, and they have their own histories and their own background. And around 10 years ago, a sort of endeavor started, an enterprise to write media art histories, which has been turned into a series of conferences. And I have participated in those conferences. And what I have seen there is something that struck me really as a bit odd, which is doing history without history, dealing with things that happened in the past without any historical contextualization, without considering history as such, and without considering the historicity, the social context of those artworks. So my idea when I started working on new tendencies was actually to find a subject, a case study, that allowed me to return to the history of media art or its prehistory, a sort of politicized perspective. And that really was my starting point. It then shifted over time. So when I decided, this book began its life journey as a PhD at Goldsmiths in London. Initially, I did sort of a curatorial practice, exhibitions as sites of research, and I was in search for a case study, and I came across the New Tendencies. And because of one Croatian colleague, artist and curator Darko Fritz, who had done work on it for quite some time already and tried to convince everybody, New Tendencies, that's the thing that's really important. And when I started to look at the subject, I found I have to answer myself a question, and that question is a fairly big question, actually. It's the question, what is history? Because New Tendencies existed for a fairly long time. It began in 1961 in Zagreb, Croatia, which was then part of a nation which doesn't even exist anymore, the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, and it lasted from 1961 till 1978. And in between, the times really changed. So, and also I was aware that in New Tendencies was held as a sort of biennale every 2 years, and the curators really tried to go with the time. They really tried with every exhibition, every conference, they tried to answer the question, what is the art most adequate to its time? And therefore also New Tendencies changed a lot. So for me, this question, what is history, is also connected to another question maybe, which is what is political? And in the end, I think my work changed a little bit. Through doing this research, I moved out of this whole field of media art, digital art, and I entered a more general art history. And I think actually, to preempt any questions, I think maybe what's political about my work is maybe the methodology, or the method. Maybe I don't have a methodology, that's too big a word, but the method. I really tried to tell the story of the New Tendencies in the context of the time. And in order to do that, I had to find a way of understanding that historical time. So I created a historical framework, which also started a life of its own. It became a project which is now going under the name of Technopolitics. And there are actually three members of Technopolitics here, my wife Ina and Gerald and Silvia, also from Vienna, Austria. And we have the Technopolitics Working Group, which is now independently of the book developing this framework of trying to understand history, trying to understand how came something like information society, network society into being. And my book actually is as a case study, is maybe a first application of technopolitics to a specific subject. Because I don't fancy myself as a kind of political scientist or as a big theorist. I don't think I'll do that anymore. I see myself more as a practitioner. But what I saw was the need to consider art in its historical specificity and its connection with that historical context, which is often for me much more than a context. So as one further remark of that kind, can't get into it in too much detail. Anyway, also, I don't want to talk too long. So my talk will be quite sketchy, but then I hope we can return to some of the topics in the panel discussion with the panelists. The kind of framework that I created initially also as an online discussion with a quite well-known American theorist, activist, Brian Holmes, was that about looking at the interdependencies of political, economic, technological, scientific, artistic currents and developments. So you can see that there are several certain phases, like the immediate post-war history, there's a sort of consensus to label it Fordism, and there's also a certain consensus that Fordism was connected to specific cultural forms and ran into a crisis in the late 1960s, which resulted in the sort of global revolt of 1968. And after this came the crisis of Fordism, and then something that was often called post-Fordism, But then post-Fordism was kind of dropped, and a new term came out, which is either the information society or network society by Manuel Castells. Maybe a bit more, actually the more accurate term is network society. So the title of the book, actually, Art at the Threshold of Information, of the Information Revolution, is really about that historicization. It's really about an art that emerged when Fordism was still at its peak and that already invented or dreamed up some of the key components of art in information society. And then when Fordism came into, went into its crisis and the changes started, that was the time, and also in a way the utopia of new tendencies started to become realized. And whenever there's an artistic avant-garde that has a utopia and that utopia becomes realized, the avant-garde is not needed anymore, somehow. I think that's a quite general law of history. So we have this post-war situation where in 1958, the Expo in Brussels was the first World Expo after the Second World War. The Second World War is of tremendous importance for the emergence of new tendencies in several aspects. On one hand, there is this this kind of newfound scientific technological optimism for which the Expo in Brussels stands. And here we can see the Yugoslav Pavilion. There was a group called Exart 51 of artists, designers, architects who started the sort of working in an abstract modernist idiom in 1951. But usually they couldn't really work in the art scene, but they could work making exhibitions, trade fairs. And they, one of them created this Yugoslav Pavilion for the World Expo, where you can clearly see the references to constructivism. So there was this prehistory also of the 1920s, 1930s, where there was in former Yugoslavia maybe a predisposition to constructivism and the international style, whereas in Serbia, for instance, there was a more a predisposition to Dada and Surrealism. What is very important to know is that Yugoslavia was not behind the Iron Curtain. It was not behind, it was not part of the Soviet sphere of influence. It was a socialist country, but Tito broke with Stalin in 1948, and then that had very, very strong consequences on several layers. One consequence was that it, Yugoslavia developed its own ideology of self-management. That's maybe something we can come back to, a decidedly anti-Stalinist socialist state ideology, which was very interesting. It also got a lot of interest from abroad. And the other thing was that Yugoslavia was the only European member of the Non-Aligned Nations Movement, which came out of an initial meeting in Bandung in 1955. And this image shows the signing of the Non-Aligned Nation Pact in a conference in Belgrade in 1961, just at about the same time when the first exhibition of new tendencies happened. And non-aligned, we will also discuss that, but it meant that those nations, they decided they had the right to be neither capitalist nor Soviet communist, but to have their own way between capitalism and socialism. And that also had a lot of repercussions for the art. And it was a kind of key condition to make something like new tendencies possible. So this is an exhibition, an image of the first exhibition in Zagreb. It was an exhibition that pioneered works which were neither painting nor sculpture, some sort of strange objects, often of some participatory character. So that's one point to flag up. For the aesthetics of new tendencies, participation was a key idea. They had a sort of didactic idea that through participatory artworks, they could activate the spectator and show them that they had a critical agency, which they then would carry over into everyday life to sort of also overcome the sort of passivity of the society of the spectacle and the Fordist sort of mass society. So that was the notion of participation through these kind of artworks. Another important notion is the notion of programmed art or algorithmic art. And the third point is the notion of visual research. New tendencies were coming just after abstract expressionism, and they sort of really were breaking sort of new ground through the bipolar logic of art in the Cold War, so that in the West there was abstract painting, abstract expressionist painting, and in the East there was socialist realism, and the new tendencies, they really developed a sort of non-aligned art, which was not just a middle ground, but something else, and that's maybe something we can also discuss a little bit later. Interestingly, there is a Latin American connection. The first exhibition of New Tendencies was initiated and co-curated by the Brazilian painter Almir Mavinier and Matko Mestrovic, Croatian critic and theorist and also radio journalist. And Mavinier was at the time teaching at the College of Design Ulm, which had a very special role in the post-war history of art and design, because what Ulm did, there they pioneered so-called information aesthetics, and they really reconnected with the pre-war Bauhaus, so they kind of brought Bauhaus ideas into the post-war era, and they also very early on adopted new scientific concepts coming from the United States, things such as information theory and cybernetics, and they really tried to integrate that into design and artistic practice. Another point was that New Tendencies was like a network of networks, a movement of movements. Here we can see works by Gruppo N from Italy. They were one of the most radical of those movements. For instance, they signed works collectively. They really wanted to destroy the notion of authorship, the notion of the artist as individual genius, and they attacked that on several levels. One level being to sign works just under the group identity and then also under their own identity. So this is a work, you can see them on the rooftop of their studio in Padua. And interestingly, there's an interesting crossing. Their studio became also the meeting place for Guarderni Rossi magazine, which was one of the starting points of Italian operaismo or workerism, out of which came Italian autonomous Marxism, which is currently, because of Toni Negri, who was one of their friends, happens also to be from Padua, one of the most important, strongest currents of contemporary Marxism. In art historical terms, New Tendencies would usually be subsumed under sort of a term such as a neo-avant-garde, neo-constructivist, and or concrete art, art concrete, that would usually be seen to be in contradiction with a sort of a Dadaistic or critical deconstruction of art. But I think that's not true. That's something that has to be reopened because for that reason. This was Gorgona, a group in Zagreb, who was a kind of proto-conceptual group very early on, about 1958 they started working, and they were really sort of a kind of conceptual artist before the name. And in the center is Matko Mestrovic, co-founder of New Tendencies, who was firmly also a member of Gorgona. So those two tendencies were also part of New Tendencies, also underlined by the fact that in the first exhibition, Piero Manzoni took place. As you could see by the previous picture, those networks of networks, groups of groups, were quite male-dominated. It was not an all-male movement, but this was before the second feminism. And I don't think that New Tendencies were particularly bad in that department. It was just a more general sign of the times. So this would be a more adequate distribution. This is the group T, Gruppo T from Milan. And in the center, you can see Grazia Obariska. She's a great artist. So it usually would be a group of five or six guys and one woman or so. And of course, there were also artists who were not working in groups, but that was about the sort of proportions. What New Tendencies tried to do, I already said, they attacked the notion of the individual artist, and they did that also by firmly being opposed to the notion of this handwriting of the artist, the individuality expressed by the painting, by the expressionist gesture. So they invented many ways of making work that was not really showing the hand of the artist, that was made through some sort of procedure or automatism. So that's a work by Group Zero, Otto Pine. That was kind of a direction in New Tendencies, which was a bit more lyrical. The idea was also to liberate the viewer from alienation, but do it by developing a sort of new sensibility. There was another direction, which was more into sort of playfulness. So as New Tendencies developed over time, the sort of notion of homo ludens became increasingly important. Here, actually, the woman in the picture is actually a famous Italian curator, Lea Vergine, who made one of the first rediscoveries, saying like New Tendencies were the last avant-garde. Interesting, always some movement is always the last avant-garde. Last night I heard that net art was the last avant-garde, so maybe we can discuss that. From those sort of participatory, playful works that engaged the viewer, they went on to make whole environments, which had a bit of a taste of the Luna Park, and that was on purpose. They wanted to make an art for everybody. You should be able to appreciate it without studying art history, and that then continued to get sort of bigger, more sort of driven also by electrical motors, electricity. And this exhibition in 1964 was a real early highlight of New Tendencies, here with a work from Gianni Colombo, Gruppo T. These groups, they went on to make complete immersive environments without computers, but the idea was always this notion of activating the spectator, liberating people from alienation, and helping the spectator. And it's always like, I was always tempted to write, it's a user. It's already the prosumer from the 1990s was already back then the subject of the work have this sort of relational participatory art. Another aspect of fighting this notion of the artist genius was the algorithmic art, to have a set of rules according to which the work was created, then as a perfunctory matter without any further interference. Most sort of hardline in that department was François Morellet, who passed away this May at the age of 90, and he superimposed grids, and you can here see the degrees of rotation, and that was the algorithm, so to speak. He said, take four grids and rotate them by those angles against each other, and that he did without any further sort of adjustment, make it a bit more beautiful here or there. And that also, as you can see, could go from a very small size of sketches to a very large size of this building. This art was starting out as something that was very self-organized, was attacking the art system, was attacking Venice Biennale and so on, but very quickly it became very successful. And what happened was that a new term was coined, op art, and an exhibition happened in 1965 at MoMA in New York called The Responsive Eye, when the aesthetics of New Tendencies became suddenly a new hype, a new trend, but the sort of political concerns of New Tendencies were sidelined, and that sent them into a serious crisis. A lot of the groups broke up as a movement. It was over after 1965, but the curators in Zagreb regrouped and then decided for a forward flight, actually starting to do visual research with computers. And that led to a new series of works from 68 to 69, to then 1971 and 1973, where new players were entering the field, new groups, if you want to say so, such as Calcomp and Boeing and Bell Labs, were suddenly the artists showing works in those shows. And that created some serious sort of ideological conflict with the old guard of New Tendencies, who were completely alarmed that corporations would win an award in the New Tendencies computer art exhibition. You have pioneers such as Frieda Nake, a very, very kind individual, also very leftist thinking. But what was interesting at the time was that the discourse on the computer came with a very ideologically tainted discourse about the computer being the better artist. It was even going so far that here a replica of a work by Mondrian was made by Michael Knoll, and actually he made a sort of test with people and asked them which one is by Mondrian, which one by the computer, and according to Knoll, the majority of people said that that actually the computer work was by Mondrian and vice versa, and they preferred the computer work. And that was a part of a larger discourse about replacing human labor through machine labor, and that's something that we right now have also with this new wave of automation, with now algorithmic art, with what happens with Google search engines and all these sort of things, where artificial intelligence suddenly is very big back in the discourse. So I think that's another important area. And new tendencies were at the very same time with cybernetic serendipity in London. At that time, between 1968 and 1970, it looked as if computer art, technological art would be the next big thing. There were major exhibitions like Art at the End of the Machine Age here in New York, Software curated by Jack Burnham, the information exhibition. But what actually happened, there was also the Vietnam War. There was 68, and there was a serious counter reaction to that in the art world. And the artists actually turned away from that, and computer art became a kind of esoteric profession, whereas actually what the young artists did was kind of maybe starting out with conceptual art and then moving into other areas such as land art, body art. This is a work by the group OHO from Slovenia. They started with sort of a special version of pop art. They made things which they called reism, and they went quickly through stages, then doing arte povera, and then actually making group experiments in nature, which they documented with photographs. And the next step, actually, they stopped doing public art, they stopped participating, and they founded a commune. And that was, in a way, a change in the structure of feeling that made new tendencies an impossibility. And so in 1973, there was the last really big exhibition and conference in Zagreb. And then they wanted to do another one in 1977. But until then, when they had sent out their calls for participation, they always had a great response. But in 77, the letters, the answers were, sorry, no time, busy, elsewhere. It's not sort of kind of, you know. And that was the end of New Tendencies was in 1978 with a small symposium, which was only attended by around 20 people. And this is where I would like to stop and invite.
Thank you, Armin, and I'd like to invite Rachel and Ava to come up as well. The project that you have undertaken with this book is really wide-ranging, and because of that, I think a really good way to approach this would just be to, like, for us to kind of ask you some questions and maybe fill in some other things where we have ideas too. But in particular, you know, what you are kind of proposing and what you've kind of sketched out is sort of, and here I'm going to steal your question, Rachel, but partly because I want you to answer the question. But what you're kind of sketching out is like a revision of all art history of this period, because some of the names that we see up there are connected with other groups, and we see them in museum exhibitions from time to time, and they're connected to Group Zero and Grav and whatever else. But New Tendencies isn't talked about in the same way. In sort of from a New York perspective of that, or the art history of that time. So I think my question is, why did this movement take place in Zagreb? And, you know, to what extent did it take place in Zagreb? You know, why did it sort of originate there? What were the conditions that made this possible? And why is that so far receded from our view today?
Well, that's a big question, actually. In a way, the book is the answer to that question, but I also must give credit to someone who tried to answer this question, Liliana Kolesnik, a Croatian art historian. She wrote specifically, I think, 10,000-word essay about why Zagreb. And one of the, to just put it more into list form, one of the things is because Yugoslavia was non-aligned, so people could participate, Western people could travel to Zagreb with visa-free, and also for people from behind the Iron Curtain, it was much easier to visit Yugoslavia than to go, say, go to West Germany or France or Britain. So that made it an ideal meeting ground. The other thing was that there was this sort of predisposition to constructivism and Bauhaus ideas and so on, which had this local history in Zagreb, also with the kind of existence of Zenit, a magazine in the 1920s, and another magazine called Dada Tank. And another reason, really, I think, is what I describe as a sort of paraphrasing Marie Carmen Ramirez, is a constructive nexus. There was really a connection between the Yugoslavia being in a catching up process of modernization and the ideas those artists had about this kind of abstract art. They wouldn't have called it abstract art, which is a total deformation of their ideas, but, you know, just for simplicity. Because for them, there was this utopian notion that their art would actually be a kind of laboratory for a new society. And that made a connection between, for instance, the artists working in former Yugoslavia, but also a lot of Latin American artists. And those Latin American artists just happened to be in Paris, many of them at the time. So many of the groups and participants were in Graf, for instance, Julio Lebarque, I think Francisco Sobrino, there was Equipo 57 from Spain, they were very strong, Jesus Rafael Soto, and so on and so on. Some of them quite big names, and some of them lesser known, Marta Boto, Gregoria Vadanega. So there was really this link between Latin American artists who also had this belief in this sort of modernization and the link with the art and the sort of a catching up peripheral nation of Yugoslavia. Why it went from view, that's like a second question. I think there are several reasons. One is to put it into a more anecdotal form, and new tendencies became very quickly very successful. And by 1963, they were nearly hegemonic. So there was the Biennale of San Marino, and the very influential critic, Giulio Carlo Agan, kind of consecrated new tendencies. The first prizes, they made two first prizes, went to Grupo N, the most politicized group in new tendencies, and Zero, the German, more sort of liberal group. And at the time, it looked like that would be the next big thing. But then what happened was actually pop art landed in Europe. In 1964, at the Biennale of Venice, Robert Rauschenberg won the first award. And you must read Serge Guilbault's book about how New York stole the idea of modern art. I mean, that was a shock, particularly for the French. I mean, the French painters, they thought they had a right to win the Biennale award, you know. And then suddenly there comes this young American with doing these strange sort of things. Yeah. And that was, and at the same time, that was also the moment when really the sort of New York-based gallery scene kind of started off and became the sort of dominant kind of really gallerists worldwide.
Rachel, I wonder if you could fill in some of that argument from the perspective of someone that's
close enough. Can you hear me? I think one of the things in the work of Liliana Kolesnik, who's elaborated, as you said, she's kind of given a little bit of a list, is that there's a kind of convergence in Zagreb of pragmatic factors, one of them being the fact, as you mentioned, the fact that it's a place where artists, and not just artists, people from East and West can all get to. There's the ability to travel there, the ability of artists to travel from there. So it's a kind of convenient meeting place. But then also, another one being the kind of local history of constructivism. But also, I think she talks about the fact, and you also pick this up in the book as well, the fact that the position of Yugoslavia is sort of uniquely amenable to the kinds of practices that new tendencies are engaged in, because of you have the kind of structural absence of an art market, which I think is an important point for these artists that are trying to really make non-commercial, non-commodified work. But also, even though it's a socialist country, it's that attitude towards art is considerably liberalized. And you don't have the kind of ideological criteria in terms of subject matter or style in the way that you do in the Soviet Union, for instance, or the Soviet bloc. So I wonder, I'm curious to what degree, I mean, you do talk about it, obviously, in the book, but I wonder, do you think that that's too neat of an answer? I mean, I've always found that pretty compelling, the way those set of ideas, but I'm wondering then, what happens in some of the other, you know, why doesn't new tendencies happen in Latin America or Paris? I'm interested to see what you think about what conditions were absent in some of the other places where there were a lot of practices similarly going on.
Yes, it's an interesting question. I think you're right. I mean, what Kolesnik describes are the conditions that made it possible. But conditions is not enough. So I think one other thing maybe was a unique chemistry between Almir Mavinier and Marko Mestrovic, and the existence also of Galleria Suvremenia Umjetnosti, the Gallery of Contemporary Art. As you had mentioned, Yugoslavia had broken with Tito, and that meant also breaking with socialist realism. There was no state-provided doctrine on art. Yeah? But at the time, it was still quite conservative, generally, elsewhere. And very smart people in Zagreb thought, we not just need to reconnect with the tradition of modern art, we need to go beyond that, we need to create a space specifically for the new forces, so they created Gallery of Contemporary Art. And it's actually in Peter Osborne's book, that's one of the first large state-sponsored exhibition houses with that name, Contemporary Art, was founded in 1954, actually. So around that gallery, a unique circle of people developed, and that included the former members of Exit 51, Wenceslav Richter, the Gorgona Group. So when Mavinier came there, he found already people who were totally international, knew what was going on, and were keen to do something.
Yeah. Can I just jump in and say this is a terrific book, and you should buy it? And I think for the reasons that have been threaded through, I mean, it's really taking up one of the most overlooked kind of afterlives of the Bauhaus. And I think we're in a moment where this many different threads coming out of the 1920s are being, you know, rethought. And I think the idea of laboratory practice and what kinds of work and perception was happening and why this, the kind of global dispersion of some of these ideas through Latin America, and then now what Armin is doing to really think through, you know, how this worked in Yugoslavia is a really seminal piece of research. So I want to congratulate you on finishing the book and publishing it. And I really think that these, you know, the tensions that you bring out around the kind of technocratic orientation of systems theory happening through practices of seriality in the 60s and early 70s, and then this other avenue, you know, you sometimes kind of orient it toward a kind of indeterminate or maybe like Dada-oriented aspects of play and sort of, you know, reanimating the perceptual apparatus of the spectator through, kind of techniques of manipulation of objects or sort of like, you know, kind of almost, I'd say, happenings like instructional, task-oriented, gallery-based, you know, and sometimes street-based, work. I mean, that's really one of the crucial axes of what's happening in the 60s, and it's just really interesting in your book how that, you know, is mapped onto an international context, you know, but also that tension, you know, is kind of brought out through, let's say in the history of the Bauhaus, how, you know, many people would say the crisis of the Bauhaus is around issues of productivism around 1923, where Gropius, you know, sort of kicks out some of the more romantic tendencies of the Bauhaus. But I think one crisis that you are sort of seeing in its afterlife is really the kind of Hannes Meyer assuming the directorship of the Bauhaus in 1928 in this more, as you call it, functionalist avenue of systems theory, which, you know, goes into these kind of technocratic ideas And then, you know, these are really just a sort of a map of some of the key concerns of the post-war period. So I congratulate you on doing that. So I don't have a question so much as just, you know, sort of thinking through that as such an important, we're in an important moment for that. So
Micah made me bring up this image, so I think he has.
Yeah, I think that some of the things you're saying we could unpick in this image. This is sort of like one of the earlier works.
Also.
Oh, there's a question.
Well. So I would maybe add a few other underpinnings for the development of the new tendencies, of knowledge and data here. I'm sorry myself, so although I never haven't been privileged to see the exhibition themselves, but knew quite a few names personally from the list here. So there are two other festivals that occurred pretty much at the same time. One is a musical biennale, which started in 1959 and featured Schaffer, Musik Konkret, John Cage eventually. So there was this avant-garde approach in music that was bubbling and came on the surface quite well already in 1960. Another one was GFF, Geff from Pansini, the father of anti-film, who collaborated with the New Films Archive founders, and Zagreb was actually third city that should have had a representation in the network. So there seems to be quite a lot besides just visual art. And all the reasons here brought up, I think, are quite reasonable and do explain a lot. There's another tendency, and I think another underpinning, a threat, it's direct, almost a trajectory between Adolf Loos' modernism in Vienna. Zagreb-born architects who were trained in Vienna. And because Zagreb was developing in the 20s, when modernism really had its heyday, its outer round was pretty much populated by early modernist buildings. If anyone knows who visited Zagreb, there is a few neighborhood blocks, of more like consisting of more like, what I would say, maybe 20, 30 blocks. They're pure moderns. They were developed between 1925 to 1935. And I see a direct link between this and then what Knieffer would do with Gorgona and certain aesthetics found in new tendencies. So maybe the Bauhaus structuralist causation can be underpinned by the other way.
There's
another thing I would just add here. It's the revolutionary, the paradigms and the discourse of revolution that was so present in the People's Republic of Yugoslavia, right? The workers' state, as it was called. There is this revolutionary tendency that I think underpins a lot of avant-garde sensibilities present in the new tendencies. Not only new tendencies, there's a lot about post-war operation art and Serbian art that is pretty much kind of trying to revolutionize art. Having in mind that science, specifically for the new tendency, science is a leading narrative behind the post-industrial society, however you want to claim it, on the Eastern Bloc or the Western Bloc, the definitions are pretty much debated around the private property or the definitions of liberty. But what underpins it is a scientific project. So I think maybe if we add these two, we could get a fuller picture of what was really happening. So.
Yeah, thank you for painting that picture. Some of those are discussed in Armin's book. But I think one of the things I'd like to focus in on from what you said, and that's in this picture and in what Ava was discussing, was this relationship among Bauhaus legacy, systems aesthetics, which I associate with the US, and the rise of cybernetic thinking within the arts, and then new tendencies, and their approach to the idea of addressing the spectator. Because I think there's distinctions that can be drawn. And
I mean, this painting by Almir Marvinier really brings all those things together in some way. It's a small painting, it's relatively small size, 32 by 24 centimeter, but he makes these color progressions which create different geometric shapes. And he was actually coming to Europe in 1950 from Brazil. He already had experienced the sort of concrete art movement in Rio de Janeiro, also Abraham Palatnik there. And then he came to Paris and expected there something to happen, and there was nothing that interested him. And then through some further coincidences, he came to Ulm, where Max Bill was teaching. And Max Bill was also had this Bauhaus connection. There was this newly formed College of Design Ulm. And College of Design Ulm was really the best text about Ulm calls it redemptive modernism. It's really about educating a new elite of German designers, artists, in a way that they would create a society where fascism could never happen again, which is some really very, very interesting idea that could happen through design. And one teacher whom Marvinier had at Ulm was Josef Albers, actually. So Albers spoke directly to the Brazilian artist Color Sensibility, and the other teacher was, of course, Max Bill himself, but there was also another Max, who is much less known, is Max Benze. And Max Benze took the concept of information theory from Claude Shannon, here from the military-industrial complex in the United States, and applied it to art. It's very technical. I don't want to get too much into detail. But that was really sort of the crossroads here at the College of Design Ulm. And it also raised some serious contradiction, because there was the Cobra group and other leftist artist group, and Oscar Jorn actually expected to be called to Ulm to teach there, and he wasn't. And then he started a sort of war of words with Max Bill, and he accused them of functionalism. So for Oscar Jorn, functionalism was a bad word, and then he started the Bauhaus Imaginist, and the Bauhaus Imaginist then with other groups together, they formed the Situationist International. And that kept being a real I love to hate relationship all through the years somehow, which is very interesting. But also, again, I see it as a bit of a false dichotomy between the functionalist wing and the sort of critical left wing, because to come back to something that you said, at Ulm, Max Bill sort of entered the crisis, and there was a new directorship, a triumvirate of directors, and one of them was Tomas Maldonado from Argentina. And Maldonado, when he was asked about the Bauhaus, he would categorically say, the Bauhaus, I'm only interested in the Bauhaus under Hans Meyer. Yeah. So that was his idea of the Bauhaus, and that's what they tried to do in Ulm.
Pick up on something you just said about the kind of false dichotomy between functionalism versus a kind of, I don't know, more playful avant-garde sensibility. One thing that I thought was interesting that you do bring up in the book, but I wonder if maybe you could elaborate a little bit, is the fact that, at least in terms of the Yugoslav participants in New Tendencies, that they sort of pulled from two different groups, which to me always seemed to be quite opposed to one another, which is, you mentioned Gorgona on the one hand, which is a kind of proto-conceptual group or kind of a neo-Dada sensibility. And then on the other hand, X.51, which is a kind of neo-constructivist group dedicated to the idea of a synthesis of art and architecture. I've always thought of those two things as being really quite opposite, sort of diametrically opposed tendencies that were happening during the 50s and in Yugoslavia. But it's interesting to think that they do kind of come together, and that it's those two groups that are forming the core of the Yugoslav wing. And I'm interested in your research. How did they see themselves as opposed, or did they get along?
Not really. I mean, there are many misunderstandings. I mean, one is some members of Exit 51 were members of Gorgona, mm-hmm. So there was an overlapping of the groups. And the other thing is that there is a precedent in interwar years. Constructivism and Dadaism were also not bipolar opposites. So after the initial wave of constructivism and Dada in Berlin, there was this meeting in 1921 when some of the more left-wing, not constructivists, but Theo von Doesburg and some of the Dadaists, Hans Richter, actually met, and they formed a new group. And that was maybe in 1922 the most radical group. And they actually then went to Weimar. They thought they could take over the Bauhaus, but they couldn't. So I think that's part of the whole DNA of New Tendencies. And that's something really that needs to be looked at more in detail, because it continues then through the 1960s and into the 1970s, where then conceptual art was seen as superseding New Tendencies. But it's also not completely true, because in a way, New Tendencies were conceptual, as I have shown here. Morellet was conceptual art. It was, there's a current article in October magazine about this debate about Sol de Witt and Morellet, because it's obviously very similar work. And also the description, the words they use to describe the work, the language, is very similar. And one is considered a crazy kineticist and op art from Europe, Morellet, whom hardly anybody knows here in the United States. And the other one is one of the most canonized museum sort of artist, global artist, superstar in the world. And I don't think it would be wrong to frame it in a way to say, like, Le Witt stole from Morellet. That's not the point. That's stupid. Yeah. But what we can see is this imbalance between the importance that the one artist has and the right. importance the other artist has.
I want to pause for a second, because Rachel's father is here, and he said he didn't think he was going to know many of the terms we're using. So I just wanted to say, go back to this work of Morellet for a moment, because you know, you're talking about this as like a strain of conceptual work, and I think that that's very interesting, the way that conceptual work sort of bubbled.
Morellet wanted to be recognized as a minimalist. He was more minimal than the minimalists. And he was personally hurt for a while that he was pushed into this category of kinetic artist.
All right.
And not recognized that he had sort of also co-invented minimalism somehow.
I'd like to introduce another term in relation to Morellet, which is algorithmic, because I think, you know, what we've sketched out is this idea of the legacy of Bauhaus being married with ideas of information theory, which are sort of directly derived from American military-industrial complex. Those ideas have other genealogies as well, but it's interesting that the one that arrived in Ulm was the American version, which is very much, you know, based on, like, radio transmissions for wartime and aiming anti-aircraft guns and those sorts of questions, which are, you know, really functionalized. So it's an interesting legacy. But the cybernetic kind of strain of New Tendencies is very much about thinking about the artwork as a part of a system that involves the viewer. So the cybernetic idea is that things aren't isolated objects, but they're all kind of interconnected and they need to be considered in a systematic way. And that's sort of the basis of systems aesthetics. But it's interesting because here we have an example of an artist who is also part of New Tendencies and making work which is really rule-based, which is also something that in some ways derives from that Bauhaus tradition, but also coalesces, you know, parallels really neatly, I think, very directly what was happening in computing, because, of course, when you reduce something to a set of instructions, it's very easy to turn that into computation. So maybe we can shift for a moment to talking about how the ideas of programmatic research articulated by New Tendencies in the early 60s then were attempted to be translated into the context of the computer through these algorithmic works where, you know, a set of operations were being performed either in an analog way or through the computer directly. And I think in the book what's especially exciting about that to me is how, like, readily you describe that as like an abject failure, which I think is like a kind of interesting, I mean, yeah, it's sort of an interesting way to.
One thing is that the first phase of New Tendencies, they made what they called, actually after an Italian term, that it was not invented by Umberto Eco, but Umberto Eco wrote a famous catalog text on arte programmata, programmed art. And that was art that was made without computer. It was a sort of analog sort of programming that they did. And here we have Austrian artist Helga Philipp, who was one of the women in New Tendencies. And you can see her art is very algorithmic. She designed an algorithm and carried it out. And with that, she invented her own methodology, like Grazia Varisco, Umbra Apollonia, and others. But the problem is then that this gets carried over nowadays into a discourse that's coming from places such as ZKM, from media art histories, where quite mindlessly they claim there is a seamless transition from this programmed art to art made with the computer. And there isn't, because those were artists who really had a very strong social agenda, and some of the computer artists did, but other computer artists were actually, as I already mentioned, Boeing, Carl Komp, and Siemens, the German computer company Siemens. And at one point, I don't think I describe it as failure, but one point was actually, it had something to do with that. It had to do with the fact that it was very difficult to get an image out of the computer. So this is Frieder Nacke, a programming in machine language, one of the first drawing machines, the Zuse Graphomat. And that was really difficult. The Zuse Graphomat, he made works such as this one with it. It had four different colors in ink, but to make a drawing like that took hours, and he had to watch carefully that the paper wasn't ripped off, that it didn't crumble, that the ink didn't spill over. So it was not seamless at all to carry over the algorithm in the software into a physical manifestation. And to come to that artist, then where that takes its most manifest form is this great work by Zdeněk Sikora, from Czech Republic now, formerly Czechoslovakia. And he was working with circles and squares. And it was becoming too complex for him. He wanted to make all sorts of variations, and that's why he thought he needed a computer. So he found Mr. Blažek, and Mr. Blažek wrote the software for him. But then Sikora didn't have a way of getting it out of the computer, so he hand-painted it, and that's quite a large painting. He hand-painted the result of the algorithm. So that's the link between the earlier phase and the second phase of New Tendencies, really, of visual research by computer. And there were a few such artists, also the Japanese artist Hiroshi Kawano, who found a very nice term for it. He called it hand coding. So this was a hand coded painting, actually.
But I think you're quite right to like talk about the material, like the craft was obviously very different. But I think the disjunct that I'm especially interested in between the programmatic art of the early 60s and the algorithmic art that began to gather momentum in the late 60s was more about the ethics. And in terms of thinking about that question, like I was thinking about how one of the reasons Eva wanted you to participate was because in thinking about like the work of Joseph Albers, in some sense you could look at some of what he was doing as like proto-algorithmic, but there was a really strong ethics attached to it, where he would maybe apply certain basic transformations to shapes, but then it was about a kind of process of testing perception. So
I think that's really fascinating about what Armin takes up in the book is the politics of form on the one hand, and the kind of rule-based algorithm in which there's a fantasy of a kind of art without agency, you know, as you describe. And on the other hand, the interesting misreadings even at the time around what op art was and what kind of perceptual experiences and ambiguities were possible and what they meant. I mean, what's the interest in a kind of visual, you know, flamboyance or something? And to kind of re-inscribe that in the case of your book into in a kind of collective politics of like, okay, the reason the rule was interesting on the one hand is because it can allow for new kinds of participation, you know, on the part of the creator, you know, and creators, and also on the part of viewers, that might be limiting in the sense that it becomes just a kind of, you know, task-based, you know, performing the task. But on the other hand, you know, it kind of gets rid of a lot of the expressionistic emphasis on the individual and the individual's creative, you know, genius or virtuosity. But on the other hand, I think this idea of op art you know, what it, what, what's, you know, why we should care about visual perception, you know, in the way that, at least in the Bauhaus, that was articulated as a politics of form that was specifically pedagogical in the sense that it's about teaching you how to see the world differently so that you can remake it as an invested spectator, invested in the apparatus of your own, you know, ability to possibly be a creator, but also to really, you know, to fall back on a sense of your own, you know, responsibility for not reproducing the world as it exists, and to really, you know, to find new avenues to connect perception to cognition, you know, to really sort of think about what you see and to think about it differently. So that's something that's a very interesting set of, you know, threads into the 60s and the way new tendencies, you know, could have did die on the sword a bit of of a kind of role-based, or at least were criticized by the SI on the one hand for having, you know, for just sort of programming situations of distraction or something, you know.
But this is a very interesting point. It's very good how you describe it, and it brings me to something else. In a way, it was also about making these little machines in a metaphorical sense, which would allow people also to handle them and create their own artwork through variations, through permutation. So you have the link here to generative aesthetics, to certain softwares that allow you to just change the parameters and it will do something. So the artist would create that machine and not the end result. Mm-hmm. And it would democratize art, that was one thing. And something that I am now exploring more with the link with constructivism, and that's really very exciting, and that's already after the book, so unfortunately I can't stop. I thought I would then go forward and create a link to contemporary digital art, but it never happened, so I'm moving backwards. And text writings have been translated into English by Struzemiński and Kobor, the Polish couple, and for them also the space, time, and rhythm, that had something very elementary, where they really saw also a connection with the very basic forms of everything, basically, of matter, of our existence. And that was on a very deep level something, maybe an aim of exploring with this art, and that had this form of objectivity they were aiming at. Rather than having the individual expression of one person, you looked for the structural patterns of how the human mind, how the perception apparatus functions.
But no, certainly this, the idea of a universality of form at the Bauhaus and the way that those afterlives, you know, spread around the world, I guess, you know, has to do with the fact that everything has form, and so your responsibility to understanding it is really, you know, the kind of the embeddedness of you in the world is to, as a creator, you know, to be able to creatively rearticulate the world, you have to understand its material constitution and its appearance. So that, you know, really is a kind of broadening, I guess, of the horizon of what art does and why attend to any one form when, you know, if you don't understand it, I guess, in its appearance and materiality. So yeah, so that is something that is kind of interesting because so much of the op art discussion is about a kind of dematerialization of like these sort of effects, but it does seem like, you know, kind of interesting as you talk about this work that's like hand-painted algorithm. I mean, it's like there still is a sort of hand at work always, you know.
And it looks good, actually.
Creator, you know?
Yeah. It looks good, better than the printed stuff.
But I think that there was a sense in the book that many of the experiments that took up the computer more avidly got a little bit lost in the ethics.
That's my claim.
I think that it would be good to maybe we can end by talking about one of the more productive avenues of art and technological engagement that was going on.
One of the claims that I make is that even the new tendencies, even the curators in Zagreb, there was a lot of focus on two-dimensional printed computer graphics. And in that, they were really maybe also, there's a very good term coming from science studies about a Cold War rationality. And that maybe they were a bit affected by this Cold War rationality and this kind of myth of the man, the problem solver. Yeah? Art was about problem solving. It was about the wicked problem, the difficult problem. And so there was an overemphasis on those two-dimensional graphics, and there were other works which were also shown in 69 in Zagreb, and they didn't get maybe the attention they would have deserved, which would have shown a different trajectory for computer art. And maybe then computer art would have been much more popular. So that is interesting. So for instance, there's this work, actually the lights on top, that's a computer-controlled light installation by the Croatian artist Vladimir Bonacic. He actually was a scientist. He worked on cybernetics. He had research projects which probably were weapons related. Actually, interestingly, at the Zagreb Research Institute, they actually did research for the Americans. So he was really a high-end scientist. And then he got in contact with the new tenancies, and he dropped out. And he started making this sort of, now we would call it a media facade. And one point that he makes is that at the time in computer art, also what Nake has been doing, computer art is the algorithm, it's a kind of mechanical thing. So how do you get this orderly thing out of it? Yeah. And what you do is you create random numbers. So in computing, you have ways of making random number generators, and that replaces the intuition. That brings in chance and randomness into the composition. But what Bonacic said is that pure chance, randomness, is meaningless for human people. And he looked into the history of mathematics, and he found something by a young French mathematician who died in the early 19th centuries, Galois, and he made He made patterns based on these Galois field mathematics, multi-polynomials. And please don't ask me to exactly explain that, because I can't. But the patterns created would be so much more interesting. So that was one approach.
One of the things in the book that I really appreciated about this artist was his insistence that the viewer needed to be able to derive some meaning from the algorithmic structure, that an algorithm that was just creating a kind of a pattern from which nothing could be derived was not useful.
He emigrated to Israel. He then did work there. He set up a very innovative center in the 1970s, continued doing, and then he returned. And unfortunately, he died relatively young of some sort of disease. It didn't work. You see some work by Gustav Metzger, which is very suitable, fitting, because he's the inventor of auto-destructive art. Yeah. The image
is
just
auto-destructive
PDF. So what most people don't know is that Gustav Metzger made a work on which he worked for a very long time, which was called Five Screens with Computer. And it didn't really copy it. It just sort of fake copied it. And these five screens with computers were supposed to be large steel sculptures placed on a public space of the size of a football field. And they would have a computer-controlled mechanisms of ejecting parts of itself. So it would be, in Metzger's sense, an auto-destructive artwork which would destroy itself over time. And the algorithm would be designed so that sometimes it's very slow, nothing happens for a week, and just one thing comes out, plop. And then when there is a big sort of festive season, then suddenly it would be like a spectacle. People would be invited, and the sculpture would throw out many things. And by ejecting elements, it would constantly change its appearance. And so that would be this kind of auto-destructive artwork. And he simply could not realize it, that somehow he failed. But for him, he considers it his most important artwork, and there are a few more examples of that kind in the book. And I think that would really show the path to an interest in computer art. But as I said, that wasn't picked up. And then people continued programming. The work got more colorful, and the prints got better. But it was an esoteric practice. It did not. The art world went into this other direction of conceptual, post-conceptual art, and the computer guys were doing their stuff, and there was no connection, really, no debate possible, actually.
Speaking of debate, maybe it's time to take a question from Sam. Hi, Sam.
You mentioned that you're very interested in
So how did they negotiate their relationship with Cold War research, basically, from the U.S.?
They just thought that you could not engage with the latest developments. You had to engage with the latest developments, and you had to try and turn them into a different direction. So there was an idea of sort of humanizing science through art. They thought, in particular, Matko Mestrovich, he wrote a text, The Ideology of New Tendencies, in 1963, to paraphrase it very briefly, but where he wrote about the general tendency, and that maybe in a sense, like Walter Benjamin talks about the tendency, was one of greater socialization and of ever more importance of science. And that's something they could not ignore. That in their own thinking, that's what they had to engage with, but they also wanted to turn it and bend it into a sort of humanization of science. So they considered not science in this positivist, reductionist sense, on that they thought also science had to change and had to become humanized through art. And only that form of science as a sort of general expression of all forms of human knowledge, including poetry, irrationality, and so on, that under this sort of umbrella, then their art could exist as visual research. And that's a great text, very hard to read. I'm not sure if the translations available are really good, actually. But that would be a very early example of a sort of new left thinking of a discourse on science and society that was connected also to a take on art, which was very neo-Marxist, based on the young Marx, to also to think about art not as a specialized activity, but as something that would be present in the everyday and would be spread and distributed just generally among all members of society. But that's totally utopian, you see, and that's what they thought what justified using information theory and cybernetics. Only but then, if in that framework, it was justified.
But the latest papers were also from the Soviet Union too in that period. So I think that their position. I think that was especially true of the Mavinier trajectory, but in Armin's book, he talks a lot about cybernetic socialism.
Thank you.
And
yes,
I think that's an interesting concept, that there's this like legacy of there are other cybernetics than the one that came from the U.S. And although we cited the Claude Shannon tradition,
there was a period when in nations such as Poland and Czechoslovakia in the 1960s, it became more relaxed. And they developed their own brands of cybernetics, and there was a keen interest also in the arts. So, for instance, in Czechoslovakia, there was an exhibition called New Sensibilities in 1967, where they also tried to bring together cybernetics, information theory, concrete poetry, computer art. All that was seen as a complex of innovative and new things which they would have to embrace. And I think I call that cybernetic socialism. I did not invent the term. There's somebody else used the term cybernetic communism before me. But at the time, also, there was a very close collaboration between Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia during the Prague Spring. And in a way, it was like a part of this historical tragedy that the Prague Spring was ended, which also ended the possibility for cybernetic socialism. And that's also contributed sort of to the demise of the new tendencies.
It's a very promising phrase, though, isn't it, cybernetic socialism? Although it may seem like you've now received all of the information that's contained in this book, I want to sort of put a pause on the discussion here to say that I think we should probably wind down, because people are, I'm sure, eager to bring these political ideas to the viewing of the debate, which we are going to be subjected to collectively en masse. But I do want to urge you to buy Armin's book, which is available at the back for a reduced price tonight, and to say thank you for coming out on this Wednesday evening to discuss these ideas in depth. as I said, I see this as like a very having very radical implications for art history, which I think will play out as we go forward. Each of you will go and curate exhibitions now about new tendencies, no doubt, and propagate this new perspective into the universe of New York art institutions.
Very well put, Michael. Yes. Exactly.
So thank you very much for coming, Armin, and thanks to all of you.